Les colloques du Collège de France.
Thank you very much for the invitation. I'm really glad to be here. It has been a fantastic day. So today I'm going to tell you about replication stress. It's the main interest of my lab. To get started right away, I'm showing you. Is it working? Yes, it's working. I'm showing you a very simple representation of a fork just to illustrate our main interest, which is to understand how replication stress arises in cells, and especially what are the sources of endogenous replication stress. So we know from the work of many labs that mainly transcription is a challenge for replication forks. And so especially when replication and transcription converge. So why is it so? Because when both processes progress along DNA, this is creating superhelical tension, like a positive supercoiling. And this positive supercoiling is acting as a barrier for both processes. So especially when the two complexes get very close to each other, then this is creating a tension that has to be resolved. What is important to know also is that behind ongoing transcription, there is negative supercoiling forming for the same reason. And this is a context that will favor the reannealing of nascent RNA to the template DNA, creating what is known as an R-loop. And I'm sure you're familiar with R-loops. There are hundreds of papers that have been published in the recent years. And I must say that we've been among the first to show that R-loops and transcription represent a challenge for replication in human cells and in mouse cells. But I must say that since this paper was published in 2009, I checked yesterday on PubMed, there have been like 800 publications with R-loop and replication in the title, and yet we still don't understand how R-loops are poisoning or interfering with the progression of replication forks. So very recently, like a few months ago, we published a paper in Ambo Journal. I'm not going to discuss that because it's published, where we propose an alternative model in which these R-loops can be bypassed by the replicative helicase, and they can be transferred behind the replication forks. So they are creating what is known as post-replicative RNA-DNA hybrids. And we propose that both the R-loops and these post-replicative RNA-DNA hybrids are a problem for replication forks, especially because they are going to interfere with the processing of the forks. So what do I mean by the processing of the forks? Well, we know from also many labs in the world that a classical response to the accumulation of positive supercoiling ahead of the fork is that the replisome disassembles, and then the nascent DNA is going to reanneal to form what is known as a reverse replication fork. Okay, so this process initially was seen as a pathological transition, but now we know that it's a very common and very well-controlled process that is very important to stabilize the replisome and to protect the replication fork from degradation. Yet, we know that looks very much like a 1-ended DSB, and means that it can be processed, degraded by nucleases. So it's very important that the cell control very closely how the fork reversal and the protection of the DNA ends is regulated. Now, something we got very much interested in the recent years is the topological constraints that are associated to this fork reversal process. Because when the parental and nascent DNA get separated during the fork reversal process, this is also creating topological tensions. And we know now that there is accumulation of positive supercoiling on this side of the fork. And this is actually behaving as a topological barrier for the full extension of the reverse fork. And at the same time, there is negative supercoiling that is created behind. And this is a good substrate for topoisomerase 1, and this is a good substrate for topoisomerase 2. So it was shown actually a few years ago that TOP2 is required in human cells for fork reversal. Now, what we've learned from the people studying chromosome condensation is that this structure is potentially dangerous, because you know that TOP2 is a pretty stupid enzyme. It will, whenever two pieces of DNA are close to each other, it will be transferred on the other side, which means that potentially these structures can create a lot of catenanes and knots. So if we let TOP2 act alone, then we clearly create a mess behind the replication fork. So what we've learned from the people working on chromosome condensation is that condensin 1 and condensin 2 are super important to have a proper resolution of these structures in the context of a metaphasic chromosome. Now, you know that condensin comes in two flavors. There is condensin 1 and condensin 2, and they are both involved in chromosome condensation in metaphase, but condensin 2, for some reason, was detected on chromatin during interphase, and there was no clear function for this binding before mitosis. So what we hypothesized, I'm not going to show you the data because it just for the sake of time, but what we hypothesized is that just like it was proposed in metaphase, that condensin 2, by creating these plectonemic structures, will help keep all these positive supercoiling together and avoid the formation of knots behind the replication fork. And we have data in yeast and human cells that indeed, in the absence of condensin 2, the fork reversal process is not working very well. Now, there is also negative supercoiling on the other side. And this is a problem because you see that there is a large chunk of single-stranded DNA that is exposed. And for instance, if you have inverted repeats there, this is going to form hairpins, and this is going to be a problem for the restart of the fork. So it's important to limit this amount of single-stranded DNA. And there again, there is an activity associated to condensin 2, which is to re-anneal single-stranded DNA. And so what we propose is that condensin 2 is also acting on this side of the fork to convert open DNA into negative plectonemes. And this, all that would be important to resolve this supercoiling tension and then let the fork reassemble and restart. So this is the work that is almost finished by Megan Damota, a PhD student, under the supervision of Armel Langron in the team, who's a senior scientist. And we are in the process of wrapping up the story, and I think we have a pretty good case here that condensin 2 is doing something new during replication, which is the stabilization and the regulation of these reversed replication forks. So why am I telling you all that today? Well, because for the next point that I want to make, I will keep the structure of the fork in a very simple drawing. And so forget about all these gymnastics, but just keep in mind that whenever the fork stalls, there is a lot of things happening at the nascent DNA, and it's extremely complex, and there are many enzymes and nucleases involved. So the point I want to make here is that whenever the replication fork poses, whatever the cause of the replication block, whether it's a drug, whether it's a transcription, whatever, the fork to be stabilized and restarted and signaled need to be processed. And there are nucleases involved that are going to digest nascent DNA to expose single-stranded DNA. And this is the part of the process to activate the checkpoint and to restart the fork. So how does it work? Well, I told you that there is this resection process that has to be very tightly controlled, and it's a process that is prevented by BRCA1 and BRCA2 together with RAT51. This is important to generate signals from the DNA, which is the main signal for ATR activation and for the activation of the replication checkpoint. And the single-stranded DNA, that's something we've shown in yeast, is important to load the coisin complex at the replication fork. And this is important to keep the two sister chromatids together if you need to engage recombination. See, this will avoid recombination with ectopic sites. Okay. So some years ago, we got interested in a protein called SIMHD1 that was known in human cells to be an HIV restriction factor. and also DNTPase. And it was known at that time that it was acting as a DNTP hydrolyzing complex by forming this tetramer. But this was very specific to non-cycling cells. And once the cells go into S phase, then some SG1 would be phosphorylated by cyclin ACDK2, and then there would be a new version of the protein, a monomeric version that lost the DNTPase activity. So since we were interested in replication, and DNTPs are very important for replication, we started looking a bit more into that. And we confirmed that indeed there is no clear function associated to this monomeric version in terms of DNTP regulation. But yet, and a bit by accident, we found that there is another activity associated to some HD1 in S phase, which is to act as a cofactor for the MR11 nuclease. So we showed in vitro, it was a collaboration with many labs, but we could show that in vitro it stimulates the exonuclease activity of MR11. And so we proposed that it was acting together with MR11 to promote the resection at the fork. And indeed, we could verify that by many different approaches. Now, what was really exciting in this story is that when some HG1 is not there, then there is another phenotype that is revealed, which is that when some HG1 is not there, MR11 and RAC1 are acting in another way. There's a new pathway that is involved, in which instead of degrading nascent DNA, nascent DNA is going to be cleaved. Eventually, it will accumulate in the cytosol, and there it will activate the cGAS-STING pathway and drive the production of type 1 interferons and pro-inflammatory cytokines. And this, in a way, explained the phenotype of Icardi-Gouthière patients, in which, in the absence of some HG1, there is a constant production of type 1 interferons that eventually lead to massive inflammation in the brain and causing the death of the patient. So this was really interesting because for the first time, we could directly connect the stalling of replication fork with the inflammatory responses through the production of cytosolic DNA. And as you heard from Sophie just before, this is important because it extends, in a way, the signaling of DNA damage beyond the cell boundaries. So in other words, normally we would consider that replication stress or DNA damage is generating a signaling that is restricted to this cell. But now with the extension of this pathway to the cGAS-STING pro-inflammatory response, then you can get the production of type 1 interferons that will eventually attract the immune cells in the vicinity of the tumor, of the tumor cells, and this will promote the immunogenic cell death. And this connection has been, now I think it's pretty well established that in any type of situation with chemotherapy or radiotherapy, the production of type 1 interferons, at least if it's during a short period of time, will be a way to eliminate to increase the immunogenic rejection of the tumor. Of course, if it persists over a much longer period of time, then this is a problem because this is promoting many bad things like metastasis. Okay, so this was published a long time ago. So since then we started looking into this question from a slightly different angle, still connected to cancer, but in the context of oncogene-induced senescence. So why was this interesting for us? Because you know that in oncogene-induced senescence, if you activate an oncogene like RAS, an oncogenic version of RAS, for instance, this is going to create replication stress through the induction of hypertranscription and through the formation of R-loops. So this is basically what I showed you before. Under these conditions, there will be much more active genes, deregulated replication, and many more conflicts between replication and transcription, then increasing replication stress, activating the DNA damage signaling, and eventually driving cells into senescence. Okay, so that was known for many, many years. But more recently, there are a few papers that came out implicating the cGAS-STING pathway in the senescence process. So this was considered completely independently of the DNA damage signaling. And so the question, knowing what we observed in the context of cGAS depletion, the question we ask is whether these pathways are indeed two independent pathways contributing to senescence, or whether somehow they would be connected together. So in the context of RAS induction, so if you assume that RAS is going to increase transcription replication conflicts, then we would expect to have more replication stress driving senescence, the classical pathway. But then if for some reason there is also the release of cytosolic DNA in these conditions, and if this process depends on MR11, then it could be that the two branches of the pathways are connected via MR11. So to remind you that in this SAMAGE1 paper, what we showed is that indeed we could detect an increase of cytosolic DNA in response to replication stress. But if we would treat the cells with murine, which is an MR11 inhibitor, then we could suppress completely the production of cytosolic DNA. So we thought, okay, if we treat the oncogene-induced cells with murine, could we suppress this pathway completely? So this is the experiment. So this is the work of a postdoc, Hervé Techer in the lab, and a senior scientist, Yali Lin. So what they did was to use a very simple system, BJ cells, immortalized human fibroblasts, overexpressing RAS in an inducible manner. And so what they did was to grow these cells, and you see that after induction of RAS, then the cells stop growing. The control cells treated with murine or DMSO, they grow, but at a slower, a normal rate. And now if we add murine to these cells, then you see that we completely restore the proliferation of the cells. And this was done with BJ, but we confirmed that with many other cell lines, and it's a very robust result. So then we went on to look at other features of senescent cells. So for instance, the induction of beta-galactosidase. So you see that in the control cells that express RAS, there is an induction of beta-galactosidase. And if we treat the cells with murine, then we lower the beta-gal induction to the background level. We looked at also at the replication fork speed. You know that RAS induction is causing replication stress, so the fork is slowing down. So that's what you can see here. These are the cells that overexpress RAS upon tox induction. You see there is a slowdown of the replication fork compared to all the controls. And if we add murine to these cells, then we restore almost completely the normal speed of replication forks. So indicating that somehow MR11 is involved in the slowing down of the fork in response to the oncogenic treatment. And if we look at micronuclei as a consequence of replication stress and also as a source of cytosolic DNA, we see that again, the oncogenic stress is inducing micronuclei, and if we add murine, then we suppress it completely. So what we propose is that actually these two pathways are not fully independent, but probably cGAS-TING is induced by the cytosolic DNA that is generated at replication stress sites by the activity of MR11. So we thought that if we want to solidify this model, we have to be able to modulate the cytosolic DNA part of the model independently. And we thought that we could use TREX1. So what is TREX1? It's a nuclease that is naturally present in the cytosol of any cells. And it's there to degrade cytosolic DNA or to keep it to a non-immunogenic level. So what we did was we thought about overexpressing TREX1 in the cells that are exposed to oncogenic stress. And the prediction would be that this should suppress the senescence process. And what we did also was to overexpress a dominant negative version of TREX1 called D18N, which is interesting because since TREX1 is acting as a dimer, when we overexpress this dominant negative, version of TREX1, then we get a dominant negative effect. So this is the experiment. So again, induction of beta-galactosidase by RAS. And at the same time, if we overexpress TREX1, then you see that we suppress the beta-gal activation, which is fine. Now, if we combine RAS induction and the dominant negative version of TREX1, the prediction is that we should have even more cytosolic DNA, even more activation of cGAS-STING, and indeed we get a much stronger senescence process. Now, what is really interesting is this data here, because this is a situation where we only deplete TREX1 activity from the cytosol without inducing the oncogene, and yet you can see that we have an induction of the senescence process. So if we look at, for instance, the interferon genes, you see that many of them are induced simply by inhibiting TREX1 activity, which we don't see if we activate TREX1 alone. So this is really surprising because it's a situation where we haven't created any replication stress. We have no RAS induction. And it looks like if we bypass this part but just generate cytosolic DNA, then we can induce senescence. And this was quite unexpected. But then there was a paper that came out that suggested that some interferon-stimulated genes, and especially a gene called ISD15, when overexpressed, is sufficient to induce replication stress in cells. And this is the work of Lorenz at Benengo in Zurich. So somehow it looks like the two branches are not only connected like that by MAR11, but there is also a feedback loop in which the type 1 interferon and interferon-stimulated genes are cycling back on replication stress to activate it. So how can we test that? Well, we thought that maybe we can bypass completely this part and this part by directly feeding the cells with interferon beta, and then we ask whether this would create replication stress and DNA damage. And indeed, that's what we observed. So this is, again, a fiber experiment where we measure the speed of the replication fork. You can see that when we induce RAS, we have a slowdown of the fork caused by the oncogenic stress. But here, the cells that are not expressing RAS, they are simply exposed to 50 units per ml of interferon beta. And you see that the speed of the replication fork is even slower than the oncogene alone. And this is interesting because it's really acting in a dose-dependent manner. And it's also inducing DNA damage that we could measure with COMET assay in a dose-dependent manner. And it's also increasing the frequency of micronuclei in a dose-dependent manner. So interferon beta per se is sufficient to induce DNA damage. And you see here that it's also affecting the proliferation of the cells. So simply by adding interferon beta, we completely stop the proliferation of the cells independently of the activity of RAS. And we also induced beta-galactosidase activity. And finally, and this was an experiment that was suggested by a referee, and it's a very smart experiment, so we are glad that we did it. What we did was to, because of course when you add interferon beta in the medium, we had a lot of, very high concentration, it's probably not very physiological. So what the referee suggested is that in cells that overexpress RAS, what if we use an antibody that would block the interferon receptor, interferon beta receptor? So the idea being that if somehow the signaling due to replication stress involves an amplification by the interferon beta response, then blocking the receptor should at least diminish the stress. And that's exactly what we observed. So these are control cells treated with the antibody against the interferon beta receptor. These are the stress cells with the RAS induction, so the replication fork slows down. And you see that if we block the interferon signaling, then we largely reduce the replication stress induced by RAS. As if the interferon beta in a cell autonomous or non-cell autonomous manner, maybe it's also acting on the neighboring cells, is contributing to this replication stress. And again, if you look at the beta-gal activity, we have also reduction by blocking the interferon beta receptor, and so on and so forth. So this is the final model. So what we propose, and the paper was very recently accepted for publication. So what we propose that indeed there are two pathways, or at least two mechanisms. The classical one that signals induces senescence through the classical DNA damage signaling caused by replication stress. But on top of that, we propose that MR11, through the production of cytosolic DNA, initiates a feedback loop that will also contribute to replication stress and somehow amplify this response to increase the senescence process. And to finish, something I wanted to mention, I just wanted to tell you a word about a study to which we contributed, which is it's a non-cancer related situation. So it's a collaboration with Sophie Hu at the Hôpital Mondor in Paris. And Sophie is studying a disease called, I never managed to say it, so we also call it Verneuil disease. So let's call it Verneuil disease. So in this disease, it's an inflammation of the skin that is initiated by an inflammation of the base of the follicle. So basically and it's a very debilitating disease, no treatment, very severe, very painful. The only way to treat the patients is to engraft part of the take the skin on another part of the body and replace the lesion with the new skin. So what Sophie found out is that in the stem cells, what they call the bulged stem cells, there is, for some reason that we still don't understand, there is a hyperproliferation. And associated to this hyperproliferation, there is a very strong induction of interferon-stimulated genes. And you see that the one that is the most highly overexpressed is precisely ISD15, which is the one that deregulates FOX speed and induces replication stress. So Sophie contacted us because she heard about our paper on SAMAGE1. So she asked us whether we could measure the speed of the replication forks in the primary cells from the patients and from control patients. And what we found was really striking is that all the cells from the HS patients, they had a much, much faster progression of replication forks compared to the control patient, to the control people. And what was very interesting is that if we would inactivate STING in these cells, then we would completely revert the replication defect. And associated to this replication defect, there was also induction of DNA damage and inflammation. So what we propose in this paper is that there is associated to this hyperproliferation of these stem cells, there is a faster replication that is associated to replication stress that leads to the accumulation of cytosolic DNA that would activate the STING pathway. This time it depends on IFI-16 and not cGAS. This would create more IC15 that would even further accelerate the forks and so on and so forth. So you have a very similar amplification loop that in this case leads to this very severe disease. And we think in precancerous lesion is contributing to prevent cancer development by inducing senescence. And voilà, I will stop here. Just to thank the people who did the work I presented today. So Megan and Armel for the part on the very beginning on condensin. And Yali and Hervé who's here. So Hervé just got a position at IRCAN. He got chair of the professor junior. So he's starting his group right now. Et voilà, and if you have questions.
Retrouvez tous les contenus du Collège de France sur www.college-de-france.fr.